Nick, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you very much for coming in. Now, you've made a big sacrifice by coming in at this hour on a Sunday afternoon.
Well, we're in the middle of a matinee performance of the play My Boy Jack, actually.
You are.
But it's not that much of a sacrifice because this is the third performance and I've been to all the other two and I shall go to the rest of them probably.
Oh, okay. So maybe it's a little bit of a blessed relief.
It could be said to be so. Yeah.
Right. So you just have to make sure that your actors are doing what they ought to be doing in your absence.
And they're left alone. They're well in control.
Excellent. So we're going to be talking a lot about My Boy Jack, which is at the Abbey Theatre, which is running all the way through until this coming Saturday, the 15th of November. Before we do, though, Nick, perhaps you could tell me a little bit about how you discovered your love for the theatre.
Oh, gosh. Well, when I was a teenager, really, I joined a local church youth club, but really because they had a very good drama group. I wasn't particularly interested in ballroom dancing and all the other things they did, but I was attracted by the idea of doing that. And particularly because one of the ladies that was running the drama bit had been a primary school teacher of mine, of whom I'm very, very fond, and she'd sort of made me interested in drama. And so she also made me very interested in The Wind in the Willows, because I can remember as a small child, we had a Friday afternoon reading from the teacher, and the one I can remember most vividly was The Wind in the Willows, and she used to do rather good imitations, particularly Mole, as I remember. That was a long time ago.
So it wasn't just reading them, but she was coming up with the voices and giving them more of a dramatic sense.
Yes. She was, her name was Miss Milligan. I never got to call her Marjorie, but that was her name, really.
Oh. So how old were you then when you joined this church?
Oh, I suppose about 13, 14.
Okay. And what are your memories of that?
Well, I can tell you about the first play I was ever in, which
is
slightly embarrassing, but I was 13, I think I was, and it was a play called, it was called Safe at Last, and it was a one-act play, and it was about an old colonel, a retired colonel, who was broken into, and the safe was robbed. That's why it's called Safe at Last, I suppose. And I played the part at 13 of a retired colonel, sort of Colonel Blimpish thing. And I remember to the dying day that I started on stage by myself with a whiskey and soda and a copy of The Times in front of me. And disaster on the first night because maybe I was nervous, I don't know, but I knocked over the glass of whiskey. So I can remember that with great presence of mind, I called to the butler, James. James, I said, come on and clear this up. And
stayed in character.
Absolutely,
right.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, so that sort of set me on the way of whenever I've acted. I haven't acted for a long time now, but I was never really terribly secure in my words, but I never dried up because I always thought of that James and the clearing up the whiskey and I could get by.
So you could improvise if necessary.
Yeah, not very fair on the other actors on the stage.
No, only on the writer probably.
Well, that's true, but they very rarely came to hear it, so they didn't know.
Okay, so that was the church youth club.
Yeah.
And then when did you start to take things a little bit more?
I did a lot. I lived in Enfield and did quite a few things with an amateur group. Then we moved to St Albans in 1979. And I joined the Company of Ten because friends said it was a very good dramatic company to join, which it is. And I've been with them ever since.
Now, we should probably elaborate a little bit more on the Company of Ten, because I know we've featured a lot of your productions in the past, but people who maybe are listening who aren't familiar with it and its workings.
The Company of Ten, you may think it's got 10 members. Well, it's got a lot more than that. It's probably got about 350 now.
Yeah.
But it was formed, actually, in 1934 by 10 enthusiastic people, one of whom was a man called Terry Newell, who was in fact the father of the film director, Mick Newell. So there's a big family thing there. Now, these 10 people formed the Company of Ten, and this was before I was around, of course, obviously, but they did shows in local church halls. And eventually, after an few number of years, they moved to a semi-permanent location at a barn that was on the land owned by one of the members down at the bottom of the Abbey Orchard, south of the cathedral. And they apparently had a fantastic time there. It was a very, very excellent theatre within its confines. But then in the 60s, the land was compulsorily purchased by the local council. I think I've got the facts right, but people who've been
But
anyway, to cut a long story short, they negotiated with the council in the 60s and obtained land on Westminster Lodge, opposite where the leisure centre is now, for the peppercorn rent, which is the thing that you often have to pay not very much for, really.
Mm.
And by their own hands, almost literally, they built the theatre. They didn't have any funding. They raised it all themselves. And in, I think I got the date right, 1968, I think it was opened by the Queen Mother, who came along. And there are people who remember that day, and with great pride, as you can imagine.
Mm.
And we are fortunate in having our own premises. with it goes the responsibility of the upkeep, of course. We don't get any funding for that, so we have to rely upon our own efforts in getting audiences and, of course, our own subscriptions. But so we are self-contained, we're self-run, and we do generally 10 performances a year. We have a main stage, many of your listeners may know this, but we have a main stage auditorium, which seats 230. And we also have a studio, which is a wonderful place. I love working in the studio. It's a more or less a square box, and it seats 78 people. It's the sort of maximum we can get in there. And we do perhaps more innovative plays there sometimes. And it's a great... We're very lucky to have all that amount of time that we can give. And we also do... We have outside people who come in and use the theatre, for which we get some revenue. That's another help. And we get revenue from our bar, which is very popular, and all the usual beers and so on, and whatever you might like. So it's a very nice, sociable, friendly place for those that don't know it. And the plays are good too, actually.
Yes, of course. Tell us about your members. I mean, because are some of them professional or none of them professional?
No, none of them professional. No. Everybody's amateur, yeah. Okay. The only paid member of the theatre is the theatre manager.
Right.
Everybody else, whether they're actors or set builders or whatever, they're all amateurs who give up their own time for it.
And give us an idea of who these people are. Is there a typical...
Typical mix.
Was it a complete mix of...
Complete mix, really. We also have a youth group. We call it a company of teens, which is rather corny play on words, you may say. But it is descriptive. They do some very good productions in their own right. In fact, one of the company of teens is in this play that I'm directing at the moment, and another one who recently was. So they feed through. Of course, with young members, very often they then go off to university, and sometimes we lose them, sometimes they come back. But there's quite a throughput of actors. We talk about the actors, but we shouldn't forget the backstage people.
Of course.
I mean, one of the things about this play that was on at the moment is it has got a fantastic set. We're not talking about the play at the moment, but we will in a minute, I expect.
Of course.
But it is a fantastic set, and we are very fortunate because we have a group of mainly retired men and a couple of women, mostly men, because it's heavy work, really. And they come on every Tuesday morning. They come along and do construction. They're ready building the next set for the next play. Then they generally go off to the pub for lunch.
Yes.
And then they come back and do some more work in the afternoon. I don't know whether they do more work when they've had a couple of beers or less work. I wouldn't really know that. But they are wonderful people, and they produce extraordinary things from simple bits of whatever, really. But it's a professional look. I think that our productions are of a standard which lots of professional theatres would be proud to have, actually. Now, that's not me saying it. And so that's sort of a bit of the background.
So what's your background within the Company of Ten? Do you remember what the first production was that you
worked
on?
Well, I do. It was in 1979, and it was a Christmas show, and it was called The Plotters of Cabbage Patch Corner.
The Plotters of Cabbage Patch Corner.
By the great David Wood, who's written lots of
been on this very programme.
Well, very likely. Yeah, yep. He's great at adapting Roald Dahl stories, for one thing, but also this particular one was his own invention, and it was a moral story, really, about insects in a garden, the good ones and the bad ones. And I remember I played the Red Admiral butterfly, but I was dressed as a proper Red Admiral, and I grew a beard for it. So I do remember that, yes, that's absolutely something we did.
And so were you in that?
I was in that, yes.
Right, when did you then turn your hand to directing?
Well, I was in quite a few plays. I suppose I can't remember the first time I directed. It was some years ago now. I think I've directed about 20 plays altogether. Not every year, but the last 5 years I've been very lucky and done pretty well one a year.
And how does that operate? Do you select a play that you'd like to direct?
No. What happens in the company, we have an executive committee with each of them with different responsibilities, and there's one person who is responsible for play selection and productions. That's not to say they will make their own decisions on their own. Mm. They could do, technically, but they would always have a group of people around them reading lots of plays and would then come up with a proposal for a season ahead. It needs to be a balanced season. The treasurer will always say he needs two or three bankers who are going to sell really well.
Of course.
And then we're allowed to have to indulge ourselves a bit on one or two of the other ones. And then having done that, we have a group of us who direct, and there are always new ones coming in, who are then invited to pitch in for a play, giving a resume of why they think they should do it. And then they have an interview. It's less of an interview, more than a sort of fairly informal chat with a group of those readers.
Yes.
And at the end of that, they decide on who they're going to ask to direct it. sometimes, I mean, I did this my last job myself a few years ago, and sometimes you get maybe four or five directors going for one play. Mm. Another time you only get one, you know, so you can't really tell. And then the director who's been selected gets on with it, really, and, you know, has auditions and casts it and gets his backstage people and stage manager and all that, and the show's on the road, hopefully.
So when did you first come across My Boy Jack?
Well, this was one that the company chose to do, partly because it's in this year of the centenary of the start of the First World War. Mm. And it was on the list, and I read various plays, and it attracted me. It's one I felt I wanted to do. And I filled in my little application form, as it were, had my little interview, and was very lucky that I was asked to direct it.
So what attracted you about it?
Well, I just think it's very well written. It's not just a First World War play. It centres on that, but it's much, much more about Rudyard Kipling and his family and how the events that occurred affected them.
And it's by David Haig?
By David Haig.
So were you familiar with his work?
Well, only this play, actually. Right. I mean, he wrote this in 1994, I think, quite a long time ago. It was first produced then. And he played the part of Kipling, because he actually is a sort of dead ringer for Kipling. Oh. And so that was, you know, some people think that's why he wrote it, but I don't think that's a very fair thing to say. And then there was a film made of it, which lots of your listeners will know of, with Daniel Radcliffe playing Jack, and David Haig still playing Kipling in the film. So it's been produced lots of times by lots of different companies, and I guess quite a lot in this year.
Of course.
This is the
centenary year, and also your 80th anniversary, by the
way. It is indeed, that's quite true. Yeah.
So give us a précis of the play. What's it all about in a nutshell?
Well, you need a little bit of background of Rudyard Kipling.
Go ahead,
first.
Yes.
Well, Rudyard Kipling, most people know a lot of, I'm sure. Mm. He was born in India. And then when he was six, his parents decided they wanted to send him to England to be educated. At six, imagine. So he was shipped off to England.
And, shipped off alone?
Well, yeah. Well, maybe a guard. I think so.
And then,
Well, he was fostered out with a family called the Holloways in Southsea, near to Portsmouth. And by all accounts, it was a very unhappy time. Mrs. Holloway was a cruel woman, and he was physically beaten periodically and had a miserable life, I think. There's no doubt about that. And that went on for about 4 or 5 years until somebody realised that this was going on and contacted his parents. His mother came over and took him on a long holiday, took him away from that environment. And then you'd think this was odd as well. They put him into a boarding school.
Which, all places.
But where he was apparently very happy and learned the craft of writing.
Right.
And then when he was 17, expecting to go to university, he was told that he hadn't got the money to do that, so he went back to India, where his mother and father still lived. Well, they were then in Lahore, and he stayed there for several years and loved India. I'm saying that because it's quite important, because it's part of his background. So he had this love of empire and India, but kind of not in a sort of Colonel Blimpish way. I think he sincerely felt. He speaks in the play of the people from India and Africa and so on being our children, and it's our responsibility. So he had this deep, deep patriotism, which is a bit unpopular these days, but nevertheless, I think it was genuine. And I think in those days, if you've got to think of the life in those days compared with now, and he certainly was a deeply patriotic man. But the other side of the coin was that he was a very dedicated and loving father. He had three children. Jack was the youngest of the three, and their eldest daughter, whose name was Josephine, died in childhood when she was about seven of pneumonia. And Rudyard Kipling nearly died himself. And the general feeling is that he never really recovered from that death. And a bit of him, I suspect, felt guilty that he lived and she died. I don't know. But that's his sort of background. And the play is centred on the First World War and the fact that he's got this conflict, really, within him. He believes emphatically, and he makes a very impassioned enlistment speech. He believed passionately that every young man had a duty to enlist and fight for England, to keep away the Teutonic hordes who were going to come and make the whole place horrible to live in. But against that, he's got Jack. At the start of the play, which is in 1913, he's barely 16 years old, and moreover is almost blind. He's got very, very severe myopia, so not really an ideal candidate to fight in the war. But even so, he felt deeply that Jack had to fight. Otherwise, he would be shunned by his friends, which people were in the First World War. And that's really what the plays about, and he does get into the army by, I won't tell you the whole story, but he does get into the army even though he's originally turned down by the medics because of his eyes. But by various strings being pulled by Dad, he does get into the army and, of course, goes out to France the moment he can when he's 18 and is killed within a few weeks of being out there. And this is factual. I mean, his body was never found. He was posted missing, believed wounded, and they never, ever found his body. And Rudyard Kipling and his wife, who was American, spent 2 years trying to find out what had happened. And in the play... I'm not going to tell you all of this because I want people to come and see it.
Yeah, no.
But they're in the play. There's a fantastic denouement when a soldier turns up in a terrible state, an Irish soldier, because he joined the Irish Guards, who has a story to tell and reveals the truth of what happened. Suffice it to say that Jack was killed in a very horrible way. Nothing unusual, that in the First World War, of course. And I think... that had a huge effect on Rudyard Kipling and his wife, and I don't think he really ever got over that. I mean, it was a terrible feeling of guilt, and that's the sort of background of the play.
And presumably, a lot of that had to do with his own upbringing, and he must have maybe battled with those feelings of perhaps he should have been slightly more protective in a way.
I think so. I think that's probably true. It's been quite fascinating rehearsing it, because you discover all these things. And you have to be careful with it. Obviously, it's a play.
Yes.
And it's got a script, and you need to research Rudyard Kipling to an extent, but you can't be too much influenced by that because you're dealing with a script.
Of course.
And you're not. Nobody's suggesting everything in the script is exactly what happened.
Indeed.
That would be. Otherwise, it'd be a rather boring play, I think. But. But it's. I just think it's a fantastically moving play. We have one scene where the soldier. We go into France. Most of the play takes place in the house where Kipling lived, a place called Bateman's in Sussex. But there is one scene in the trenches where the guardsmen are in the trench. Lots of soldierly language, I have to say.
Yes, I saw that on the press information, so there's a strong language, but I guess it's appropriate, isn't it? It's not gratuitous.
Not at all, absolutely not. I mean, soldiers use, particular words.
Absolutely.
If they didn't use them, they wouldn't say very much.
Yes.
And if you're under fire and you're hearing shells going all around you, and you're an Irish, you're not going to sort of say "oh jolly good" or "ho ho ho" or anything like that. It's going to be a little bit more fierce than that, I suppose.
Well, anything else wouldn't be true to life. I think
that's absolutely true. Yeah. But nobody seems to have objected to it so far.
Good.
That's a good start.
Well, that bodes well. So you mentioned that it's required quite a bit of research. How have you been doing your research? Is it online?
Well, the internet's a great thing.
Yeah.
I mean, But he did write a book. He wrote two books, actually, about the Irish Guards. I mean, John Kipling, who was known as Jack in the play, went into the Irish Guards, 2nd Battalion of the Irish Guards. And Rudyard Kipling wrote two books, histories of the 1st Battalion and the 2nd Battalion of the Irish Guards. I can't imagine anybody reading it from cover to cover because it's terribly small print and it's very thick, and it's not a great narration, really, but he does talk about various things. And on one page, where he's sort of listing certain things that happened, certain battles, he just mentions sort of in passing that Lieutenant John Kipling was killed. That's all he says about it. That's his son.
Wow.
So it's a very sort of disinterested account. So that, but that's something he did.
Do you think that was just part of the artistic construct he was creating? Because it must have affected him.
Oh, very much. Yeah, well, certainly did. Yeah, I mean, he did it because he felt he... I don't know quite where he did it. It's very interesting. I mean, he did it, I suppose, because he wanted to research the Irish Guards himself. I don't quite know. It's difficult to know why he did it, anyway. But he found it difficult. He found it quite a daunting task.
Before going into too much detail about, the look of it and the sound of it, what's the first thing you do? I mean, obviously you do the research, but then in terms of getting an idea of what kind of production you're going to be mounting, how the rehearsal process is going to work, how do you go about that? Is it just a lot of thinking? Do you have to sit down with an empty sheet of paper? Does it gradually come into your head? What's your way of working?
Well, I always start off with a basic main idea of how I want to see the thing evolve, and then I suppose it is a question of the sheet of paper a bit, you know, and scribbling ideas down. I have fairly clear ideas before I start rehearsing, but the way I work when directing is to allow quite a lot to evolve while you're rehearsing. I mean, I don't think it's a good idea, for me anyway, to start off with terribly set ideas. It's not very, I think it's a bit insulting to the actors apart from anything else. Mm. You have to work together, and I'm very lucky. I've got a fantastic cast of 8 people, who all of whom are highly intelligent actors, very good people, and we've had a fantastic time in seeing how this thing evolves. I mean, you know, we'll spin ideas off each other. You know, I have obviously basic ideas how I want it to work, and we'll work to that. But with independent bits that happen, it's very much a question of evolving it. We started rehearsing for this on the 1st of September. And our normal rehearsal schedule is to have 3 rehearsals a week, and a Monday, Wednesday and Friday. And later on in the process, we add a Sunday afternoon. So it's really over a fairly condensed period of time. This was something like 7 weeks from when we first rehearsed. I think that's a good way of doing it. I think you go longer than that, you can get bored and it can get tedious and not very interesting. I wouldn't find it very easy to do that. But I think that way, you're working in a pretty concentrated way, calls on people to give up quite a lot while they're doing it, but they're happy to do it, I'm happy to do it, and hopefully the end result pays off.
So I take it you audition to find your cast?
Yes, we normally have 2 audition evenings, or sometimes a Sunday afternoon, which we publicise through our in-house magazine, and people come along. Sometimes it can be really, really hairy, because you get your first audition evening and sort of one person turns up. It's not unknown for that to happen. Mm. Several years ago, I directed a play called Abelard and Eloise, which is about the story of the monk Abelard. Yeah. And after 3 auditions, I had neither an Abelard nor an Eloise, which is slightly unsettling.
Yes. But
ended up with 2 fantastic people. So sometimes you have to sort of ring around people and persuade them to come along.
Yes.
Depends what other people are doing. I don't know. But
And what do you get them to do in their audition? Is it to read some of the play, to bring a prepared text?
No, I normally make a suggestion of passages that I will be working on, not necessarily a specific one. I won't say, "Look, come along and read this passage," because I don't think you can do that. But I will be concentrating on this passage, so think about that. Come along. I don't see any point in asking them to learn words before they come. Mm. That's really pointless, because I actually don't think that actors should, or amateur actors really, should necessarily learn their words at first rehearsal. Mm. It's not terribly helpful, because...
No. Well, not even pros do that, do they?
Pardon?
Not even pros
No. You've got it, because as you evolve the way you're playing the character, if you've got the words in your mind already, it's difficult to do that. You're unscrambling what you've already got as a sort of set idea. You
Absolutely,
know?
And gives you less freedom, presumably, as the director to get them to play with it.
I think so.
So you're assembling your cast, and I guess simultaneously you're assembling your production team.
Yeah, well, you do that early on, if you're lucky. I mean, I've got a very, very good stage manager. In fact, 2 stage managers. Both of them are experienced, but they're both very busy people, so they are sharing it. One is very, very good at the administrative side, and the other one is much more technically orientated and can liaise with these Tuesday morning gentlemen that come along and build things and probably join them for a beer afterwards as well, I expect. So that works very, very well. And then between us, either the stage manager and on their own or me with them, we'll draw together the other people, the lighting people and the sound and assistant stage managers and so on.
And presumably a designer.
Well, the designer. Now, the design in this case has been very, very important. Well, we've got a wonderful lady called Judith Goodban, who has got a fantastic eye for detail and for what a set should look like. Very good at set dressing. But I asked her if she would actually design this set from scratch. Roger Kipling lived in a house called Bateman's down in Sussex, and she and one of her sidekicks, if you like, spent a day down at Bateman's. photographing, oh, well, they told the people down there what they were doing, photographing the drawing room, which is where this takes place, taking measurements and looking at every single detail. And she has reproduced a set, which I guess is the nearest you'll ever get to actually seeing Bateman's, unless you go down there. It is quite fantastic. She was actually apologetic that we couldn't have a fireplace the size of the actual one in Bateman's because our stage wasn't big enough. But it is a superb set. But there is another bit of the action which takes place actually in the trenches in France.
Yeah, how on earth do you recreate that?
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, I read lots of reviews of this various productions up and down the country, amateur productions and provincial ones and so on. And almost all of the reviews, whether they thought the production was good, bad or indifferent, would make the point that the scene changes, particularly the one that took us to France for what is, after all, only about a 10-minute sequence anyway, took far too long. I mean, some directors had tried to make it far too fussy. And there was one classic one, apparently it was 6 minutes to do a set change.
That's a long scene change.
Absolutely. You know, I guess sweet packets were crackling and people were chatting. I could imagine what was going on. I actually said I had an idea of how I wanted it done. I was sort of Captain Blackadder and knew in broad terms what I wanted. And Judith became my baldric and produced the cunning plan. So we have a very ingenious way of doing it. And I went on record at the beginning of the rehearsal period and said, I would put money on the fact that this will not take longer than 49 seconds. Why 49 seconds? I don't know. It's the first number that came into my head. And I timed it, and it took 36 seconds.
Wow.
So I think we've done quite well there. And it is brilliantly done by three soldiers who create their own trench. I'm not going to tell you exactly how it happens because I want people to come and see it.
Of course, of course.
But they do. They come along and this trench is produced, erected. Lots of it is already in position, but I can't go too far because
I'll tell you exactly how it happens.
It does work exceedingly well. It's very dramatic.
And so then presumably you have a technical rehearsal when the design, the stage management...
Well, we have a technical meeting where we talk to the lighting people and the sound people.
Of course.
And, the wardrobe is another incredibly important aspect for this play.
How do you manage to get
Well, we had to hire the soldiers' uniforms.
Sure.
There are three guardsmen in the trenches, and there are two officers, because there's a medical scene where John is examined and has to take some clothes off and looks very embarrassed. It is very funny, really. So we have two officers and these three other ordinary soldiers. So we had to hire those. There's no other way around that. But other than that, I mean, the costumes, the dresses for the ladies are absolutely beautiful and very varied, and the men's are very authentic. But that's all taken. We've got our own big wardrobe department, and they will either have come from there, adapted from there, or in some cases actually made by our wonderful wardrobe people. A lady called Leslie Ivanson is the artistic visionary behind all of this, and she's been absolutely fantastic, and she loves doing it. She's very strict. You know, if there's a button in the wrong place, she'll say, no, no, no. In 1922 or whatever, a button wouldn't be there. It would be somewhere else. And she's very precise about that. And that's important, I think.
Of course it is. So we know about your cast. We know about your production team. Tell us about the art of directing. There will probably be people listening who may go to the theatre and they can see what the actors do. They can see what the set design has done. They can see what the costume people have done. But they might not be able to put their finger on exactly what you as director have done. What is directing? Is directing all in the casting? Is it in the guiding the actors into finding their interpretation? Is it telling them where to move and when? What is it for you? Is it all of those things or is it none?
I suppose it's a bit of all of them. I'm not very good at telling them where to move to. I think it's, again, if you've got intelligent actors, that's a bit insulting to them. I think it works. But then, of course, you can see what they can't see. And if somebody's obviously in a bad position where they're blocking somebody else or masking somebody else, you tell them and you discuss, well, don't you think it would be better if you were, you know, behind that chair or sitting on that chair? You know, yes, I think it would be. And so it evolves, quite frankly. I mean, that probably sounds a bit vague, but...
So you're an outside pair of eyes.
Yes, I think that's right. And other directors will probably give you a completely different answer.
Oh, well, that's why I asked the question.
Exactly.
I know.
But we get together. We read through it. Having cast, we then read the play as a cast, just read it, and then work on it from there. We don't necessarily do it in sequence when we're rehearsing. I mean, for example, with this play, I had one period when two of the actors were away for a week and a bit. That's fair enough. I mean, I knew that in advance. Mm. So you can schedule your rehearsals around that. But it can happen, and you just have to sort of adapt. I mean, for example, there was one quite tricky scene between two people, which is very important. And I set aside a complete hour and a half of the one evening's rehearsal just with those two, just working on it. And another one where there's one person who has got a very difficult sequence to act out. So she came along and we worked on it for an hour or so together to talk about how she should do it and what I thought, what she thought. I think it's a question of cooperation between cast and director. I don't think, well, I'm not any good at telling people what they have to do. That's, it works. But at the end of the day, if something doesn't look good, that's my responsibility not to let that happen.
Talk just about the audiences. How easy is it to find your audience? I mean, it's cold. The nights are getting earlier. There's stuff on the telly. Well, there's hot soup at home. You're in competition with professional theatres, you're in competition with all kinds of other reasons why people aren't going to come to see you.
Yep. I would say it's getting more difficult.
Why is that, do you think?
Well, you've partly answered the question yourself. It's partly other attractions, like sitting at home in front of the fire and watching the television or whatever. It's also the fact that people don't seem to... I mean, a bit of a hobby horse, this. People go up to London to see a play and they pay... maybe £40, that's modest at in least, some cases, for a ticket. They've got to get up there. They get home late at night. Probably the trains, I believe you suffered from the trains today, you told me, and the trains can be not very friendly to you late at night. And it's a bit of a hassle, and they pay a lot of money. Well, I'm not blowing our trumpet particularly. Well, I suppose I am a bit, really. I think that by common consent, most people say the majority of plays we put on are of a very high standard. And, you know, for whatever it is, £11 or something, you can come along and have a really good night at a very good, very comfortable theatre. Mm. The seats are very, very comfortable, with a good bar, a nice, warm, welcoming atmosphere. I can see a play for, I don't know, a fifth of what you would spend going to the West End, no doubt about that. But it's quite difficult to get people away from that.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I really don't know. It's amazing the number of people in St Albans don't even know that the Abbey Theatre exists. A few years ago, I happened to be house managing, because we all do different jobs.
And of course.
I was house managing. And I always, when doing that, I always sort of ask people as they go out, good night. And, you know, if somebody I don't recognise, I might ask them what brought them there. And this lady said, oh, well, I've come because my brother is in the play. Mm. It was a long while ago, and I said, have you not been before? No, it's the first time I've been. I said, so you come from a long way? No, I live in Prospect Road. Well, people who know St Albans will know that Prospect Road is the road that's right opposite the entrance to Westminster Lodge. Mm. So I said, you've just moved there. No, I've been living there for 15 years, but I didn't know you existed.
Wow.
Now, that's probably partly our fault, maybe. Mm. But I don't know, it's a very difficult question, and it doesn't get any easier. I think at the moment it is quite hard to get... But even so, we will, hopefully, for most productions in the main theatre, we're probably average 70 or 75%, hopefully a bit
which
more.
Which is very good.
But in the studio, we quite often sell out, because that only seats 78 people.
Mm.
So we do quite well, actually, quite honestly.
Do you think if you'd gone to the Abbey Theatre with a radical reading of My Boy Jack, because it's perhaps a lesser-known piece... Do you think that affects the extent to which they, or indeed an audience, would embrace a more radical take on it?
I think that would be all right, but actually with this particular play, you can't do it very differently from the way it's written, actually. But this particular play, because it's of its period, and I think it's quite... There are some plays that are actually set in a period.
So it has to be the First World
War. And I think so. Right. I do think that's true. But well, there are a lot of other plays where it's it can anything goes, really. You can set a play in whatever period you like. But I think something like this, which is specifically... It starts in 1913, it actually ends in 1933, when the announcement is made that Hitler's just become Chancellor of Germany. And Rudyard Kipling ends with the words, all for nothing, all for nothing. Because, you know, all the... Here we are back again, 25 years later in another war, which is not a nice thought, really.
No, not at all. You do have an audio-described performance.
Yes.
Is that something you normally do for all of your
Well, it's quite a new departure. It's something that I think I'm right in saying, again, there are people that know more about it than I do. They'll probably correct me on this, but I think it was first introduced at Chichester, the theatre in Chichester, a couple of years ago. And what it is, it's audio described for blind or partly sighted people. And the amount of work that's put into preparation for this is unbelievable. I mean, we've got two of our members who did very intensive training with the woman who does the professional thing at other theatres. And they have to come to several rehearsals, and they have to get notes about the play and look at the things they are going to describe and the things they're not. You can't describe everything, obviously. So you've got to pick out the important things.
There's obviously dialogue being spoken.
Of course, yeah. I can't imagine doing it. I can't quite understand how they can do it, but it's very successful. I say successful. We don't get a very big take-up of the offer. I mean, I think we'll be doing it next Thursday, and I think at the moment we may have two or three people who have signed up for it, no more. But then they discovered recently that when they went to, I think again it was Chichester, where they did quite a long run, they averaged about two or three for the performances they did as well.
Really?
So it's quite difficult to get people to come. I suppose if you're a blind person, it must be very difficult to make that jump.
But it's, you know, it's great that the the opportunity is is there.
Well, I mean, I do work with the St. Albans talking newspaper,
The
Blind.
Neighbours.
And I edit one of their editions.
Yes.
And we publicise it on that, obviously.
Of course.
So I publicise it here and say, any people who feel they'd like to, just ring the box office and say, we would like to take advantage. And they'll be given a pair of headphones and everything. We'd like to have more people doing it.
Do you have a list of plays after this that you'd like to have the opportunity?
We know the rest of this season.
They're all.
I can't remember them off my cuff.
Fair enough.
But they're all spoken for. We've just actually the decision has just been made about next season, but I can't divulge that.
Okay. With a lot of plays, it's a question of when the rights become available.
Yeah, that's right. And you can be stopped in your tracks. I mean, a few years ago, we were going to do a Harold Pinter play, and I've forgotten which one it was off the top of my head. But then we were about 2 weeks into rehearsal, and we were suddenly told we couldn't do it because there was going to be a professional production.
That seems to be a bit unfair after you've even started rehearsing.
Absolutely true. So anyway, that's when I was doing the productions job, and I got on to the publishers and sort of appealed against this. Because we were doing it in our studio.
Yes.
If we sold every seat, we'd get about 700 people over a week to 10 days. And this was being done somewhere, I don't know where it was. And they agreed, and we were. But they actually said, provided you don't advertise the name of the play.
Right. That would be a novel way of advertising.
A very novel way of, yes. Well, we did. We had to do it. They said, you mustn't have anything on the poster. We told people, and then it just said, a mystery play is being put on, and we sold out.
How bizarre. Well, maybe that's the answer.
Well, there you are. It could be.
That's the answer.
We certainly sold out. And, there we go.
Nick Strudwick, it's been an absolutely fascinating hour. Thank you very much for coming in.